Good evening, gentlemen. It is another episode of the Edgy Futurist podcast. Thanks for listening. If you are your first time guest, thanks for joining us. If you are listening on episode 190 or whatever we are, or you've listened to everything we've ever done, thanks for joining us again. Gents, how are you? How's your week been? Did you enjoy the bank holiday?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I completely forgot we had an extra day off this week. And
it wasn't really an enjoyable, but it's not about enjoying a bank holiday. It was obviously an important time in the UK, wasn't it? But I don't know if anybody else has found that your days, you still think it's Wednesday today because it's the days run into one, don't they?
Yeah, man.
I've just realised I look really low tonight. I think my hydraulics on my lovely chair have gone, so I just automatically just sinking. So I'm not going to put it back up because I'm just but yeah, it was as a father of two young children, they definitely would have not sat still for longer than 10 minutes. So we had a fun packed weekend, but we did listen to it on the radio and listen and then tune in. But yeah, it's been a good week. Been at home again, working from home. Next week, getting out and about. So it'd be nice to do so, but it's been nice to have the summer at home, working from home and yeah, been around the family and everything. So, but yeah, it's been a good week. Positive one. Definitely. Fun stuff.
I've literally just come out of a governor's meeting at the primary school where I'm a governor. So we've had some really lovely conversations and Steve will be glad to know they want to buy some Chromebooks. So yeah, that's always good news. Not that old Steve does he sell Chromebooks, but we always make jokes about Chromebooks make the world go round, don't they, Steve?
If you want to buy one, I want you know what the website is, not edgyfuturist.com.
Website, I thought you sold them on the market. Do you not have that big long trench coat?
Not anymore. They moved me on, mate. Yeah, they moved me on. The guy with his suitcase and the DVDs is long lost departed, and also I just can't fit many devices in a suitcase, can you?
What about leeches? Do you have any leeches for this? Wasted. So, Dan, what about you? Good week?
Yeah. Just everything's coming along all right. Yeah, I can't really. I'm doing some stuff at work. Can't really talk about it at the minute.
Are you working for MI5?
SBS, isn't it? Special boat service.
Yeah. No, it's going well. Yeah, we're having a bit of a reorganization of my team at work, so we're pushing ahead on that. But it's interesting because I suppose just it's that whole thing of modernizing education and making teams more modern and increasing skills, and to do that you've got to reorganize teams and the difficulties that come with that. So it's it's a difficult time, but in a few months' time, we're going to have a new team that's ready to take on the challenges of modern digital education.
Sweet.
Yeah, been through it. Positive. We're here for you, mate. So if you need a hug.
Yeah, cuddles all around. We'll give you a virtual cuddle, but in one day we'll see each other again, and then we'll really cuddle. It'll be a proper cuddle then when we see each other.
Got a guest. Wait backstage, going. Literally, what am I walking into here?
What are we walking into?
What is going in? Literally, if he's left before we try to bring him in, we apologise. It'll just be us three carrying on and rambling. But
I think we should probably bring our guest in. So not before we press the button to bring him in. We are pleased tonight to be joined by not only is this person Edge Futurist of the Year this year, which was brilliant, and I know that he'll talk a little bit about what that meant to him, but he's also the CEO of 8 Billion Ideas. So we're gonna get into that, talk about what that is. So it's brilliant to have David Harkin joining us today. Look at this studio. We were just saying just before we went on live on there, that is a brilliant studio. If you're only listening on a podcast, you need to check this out because somebody has got branding down to a T in the background, in a standing studio, the T-shirts on and everything. This man understands Brandon.
Thank you. Good evening. I feel like I need a cuddle now.
Anytime. If we can have a cuddle in that studio, there's like grass on the wall.
No, I just need like whatever I need over there. But yeah, we're very, very happy with that. I like it. It's nice. It means you can never forget the name. right? That's important. But absolutely, lovely to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us, David. I think let's start there. Let's start with 8 billion ideas, because I think it was 7 billion ideas. It's now 8 billion ideas. What is it about? What, if for somebody who's never heard of it, just give them a little elevator pitch about what 8 billion ideas is.
Yeah, cool. So look, we have a very simple mission, which is about giving students the skills and belief to go change the world. I've never met a child any part of the world who doesn't have an amazing imagination, but every child is on a different journey with sometimes the amount of skills they've got, or indeed the belief that they have. So that's a big responsibility that we have. We concentrate on four key areas in education. One is around entrepreneurship. Second is career education, skills for the future. And the last one is performance and well-being. So very much the extracurriculum space, but it's so important to be kind of integrated into the curriculum, into the timetable as well. So there are four core areas. Why? Schools produce more entrepreneurs than any other profession. One in five students are going to go on and be an entrepreneur in the future. So it's not just about, you know, learning the ways, skills to start a business, but having that entrepreneurial mindset, no matter what you want to do in the future, we think is really important. Career education, you know, I genuinely believe we are in a world of amazing opportunity for young people where they're no longer limited by zip code and postcode to opportunities. But if you hear enough of the skills gap and all the problems out there, you know, you start to believe it. So we really try and blow up the minds of young people about what they can go and achieve. When it comes to skills, we really concentrate on creativity and problem solving. And the reason there is because the last 50 years, the World Economic Forum keep on publishing different lists about what skills people need, but they're the only two things which have been consistent throughout that period and will be for the next 50 years. And then the performance and well-being, we're doing a really exciting project with Sir Clive Woodward and a ski academy in France, actually, which is taking a lot of lessons out of elite sport and making it relevant for students of any kind of ambition. So we love those four areas, and we use tech in a different kind of way. So we kind of describe ourselves as an ed tech company with a dash of services really getting into schools when we possibly can. And I hope that is a decent elevator pitch, given that we teach elevator pitches to our kids.
It's a big building that you've just gone up in. It's a long elevator ride, that one, but it was a good elevator pitch. Yeah.
You've fallen asleep by the top of it.
Yeah. David, I think what you're doing is it's fantastic, to be fair. And I think we're big advocates of the fact that we need those skills in education, and actually those types of skills very often get pushed out because there's an intense curriculum that needs to be covered. There's exams that need to be prepared for. I think probably the closest I did a few years ago, did a bit of teaching on the BTEC award I forgot the name of it, and I was teaching it. BTEC award. It was Enterprise. That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's probably the most I've seen kind of business skills and entrepreneurial skills being brought into the curriculum. But again, it's put in a very, very schooling type way. And it's an interesting one, because actually the curriculum actually advised visits to workplaces and doing like apprentice style activities. And actually, I know certainly where I was teaching it, all of that just got squeezed out, and it became just another knowledge-rich curriculum like everything else, which was unfortunate. But yeah, I suppose where did this come from? Because I know you worked at IBM, you had a bit of an illustrious career before you moved into 8 billion ideas. So what made you make the jump? Why did you leave that good prospects you had there?
So two things. You're quite right. Enterprise education, you know, I've often found that schools are doing something in this space, but they're not strategic, and often it's too late, and we've all got a misunderstanding about it anyway. You know, two of the biggest problems, particularly in the UK, are some television shows such as Dragon's Den and The Apprentice actually set the wrong mindset. You know, it's mind-boggling the amount of teenagers which think the only way to raise any capital is going on Dragon's Den, and the way to act and behave in a business is what they see on the television. So we're tackling so many different myths, and it happens too late. We should be talking about entrepreneurship and inventions to 3, 4, 5 year olds, getting them excited about their ideas, because it's way more than just coming up with an idea and getting money and pitching. You know, that's potentially one part of it. There's a thousand different things you need to learn, and there's a massive fascination in it by our teenagers. Nearly 70% of students have expressed an ambition to start a business one day, but just don't know how to, don't know where to start. And that's a common thread as you go into adulthood. So lots of things there about what needs to be done better. I guess where it started actually was, you know, it was just a conversation. It was a friend's birthday. If I'm allowed to say, it was a pub idea originally. It was a bank holiday weekend a number of years ago, and we were just sharing like fun, thoughtful, different ideas. We didn't start the day trying to come up with an idea which would ultimately change my life. But I did turn around to one of my friends and said, isn't it bonkers? We always come up with ideas, and we're kind of self-proclaimed ideas people, but we don't really know what to do next or what happens. And I just remember looking across the pub I was in, there must have been 200 or 300 people. And I just said, imagine how many ideas are lost on a daily basis. And then think about the planet. It was passing 7 billion people. And I said, we should build a business, right? We should build an organization called 7 Billion Ideas, which is about inspiring action, connecting people with their own ideas. And a few of my friends kind of stopped at that point and was like, actually, that sounds quite interesting. And I got my phone out and literally was like, I'd just go see if this domain, like assuming the domains and the names wouldn't, you know, might have been taken, and they weren't. So I literally bought 7, 8, 9, 10 billion ideas on the phone when I was sitting there. Woke up the following morning and I gave my brother a call, who's a cross-brand designer. It was a bank holiday weekend, like last weekend. And I said, look, I've got this wicked idea. I need your help in kind of like, I need a little bit of visualization here. I need a little logo. I need a little website. Just literally, I'll buy you dinner if you spend 2 hours just helping me get this idea out of my head. And he kind of came back with a logo, and that was it. And I just couldn't let the idea drop. I was pretty relentless. So I was on the director's path in IBM. I was enjoying it, but I was getting a little bit corporate claustrophobic. I was feeling a little bit like, I want to make an impact. I want to make a difference. I had a big passion for education. And then the transition was, I used all my holidays. I used any time I possibly could to get into schools and learn what was going on. So I went to compressed hours, so IBM was supportive from that point of view. So I could sneak back a day a week to go into any school that would take me and say, you know, can I learn? Can I try stuff? Can I speak to students, do an assembly? And we designed this Think Big, Dream Big assembly, which was literally proving to children that they could come up with an idea that could change the world in 15 minutes. And the feedback was just wicked. And that was it. I knew that was where I needed to be. I needed to be in schools and building an education company. So that was the transition. And then sitting down with people around me, I'm going to leave this corporate career. I'm going to go start this business over here in education. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was the feedback we were getting from the schools and the children. It was an easy decision.
Yeah, you say it's an easy decision, but I think it's a really brave one as well. And I think it's really quite inspiring listening to somebody like you said, you're on a path to a certain level of success and whatever else. And actually, there was a conversation that went in that said, I want to do something different. I want to do something that has an impact. I want to do something for young people. And I think that's, first of all, I think that's admirable. But I also think there is something quite powerful to suggest that when you have an idea, you're actually living proof of what you're talking about here, isn't it? So you had an idea and you're saying, well, I want to run with that, and this is how I need to run with it. I need to get this in place. I need to get other people to help me with a system. And I suppose your story then becomes the story, an example of the story that you expected for young people, isn't it, as well? Although you had already gone down a journey and they were starting on their journey, there's this idea about following through with an idea. So I wonder if you can just explain to us what that means. So obviously you've got these four pathways, these four areas.
Yeah.
And then, so from a practical perspective, what does that look like? Are you creating a new school? Are you creating online events? Or what does that look like?
Yeah, so our first instance, you're quite right. Like, there's a lot of myths. Like, when loads of people come up with ideas, sometimes someone said to me, a late friend who passed away, actually said the biggest mistake startups forget is to start, right? Just start, get going, be prepared to learn, be prepared to pivot. And I'm really proud. Like, we just got going. We just learned. So, and that was the biggest thing. Sometimes you don't have to take, you don't have to put everything on the line. You take a little bit of time to let the idea nurture, to develop, but get going on it. And it's not always sitting behind a laptop and just coming up with some business plan. Get out there, talk about your idea, get the feedback, and learn quickly. What then happened for us is we really identified one big problem, is that entrepreneurship wasn't being taught properly in school. So that was the big focus of 7 Billion Ideas. And effectively what we did was build up a services company teaching entrepreneurship. The challenge that we had was you could only really be in one or two or three schools at any particular time. And there was millions of children, not just in the UK, but around the world, who could benefit from this learning. It's a big headache. So how do you go from taking this experience, this, you're getting great feedback from your clients, and how do you create something that could potentially impact students around the world? When COVID hit, you know, speaking frankly, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, it was like being punched in the face constantly. Like, you just didn't expect it. It was like, what is going on here? Like, I've just left this corporate life. I'm chucking everything into to trying to build 7 Billion Ideas. And then suddenly you're just being, you know, just punched at, like, and you don't know what's going on. You're trying to control your own emotions, and you're thinking about, you know, your students, your schools, your partners, and doing the best you possibly can. But there was a pivotal moment for us. We got a brief from a challenge from one of our schools saying, look, our children have been locked down 3 months before what UK is about to do. We've got 400 children, and said, we need something. And we were like, right, what we're going to do is create a little course called Home Hack, which we're going to do virtually. It was our first entrance into that virtual space. And it's going to be these children who are in lockdown in Hong Kong. We're going to create inventions which can solve problems at home. And the kind of pebble drop for me was when we asked them to do some prototyping, and the message was, go find whatever you can in the house, the plastic bottles, the cardboard. And we got these pictures, and I was like, this is quite special. If you use this screen properly and you don't, you use it in a way that, don't write lessons, write scripts. Like, if you're going to do it, our competition was completely changed. It was actually grabbing the attention of a child, and your competition is YouTube and Netflix, if that makes sense. So that was a big moment for us. Let's use this screen really, really well in the way that we engage. We got constant feedback. We took like MPS scores. Like, when you ask a 10-year-old to score a lesson out of 10, it's quite daunting. And you're asking them every half an hour, what do you think? How can we do that? But we learned really, really quickly. And that's when 8 Bill was born. So we were thinking about, okay, if we build a piece of software that can facilitate these lessons, can provide courses, give access to mentors, and use the screen really, really well, we can reach more students. So what we've effectively built is our platform, which now allows timetabled experiences and lessons using the screen, so using the power of the webcam into classrooms all around the world. And schools which can't put us into the timetable just for logistic reasons, they use our broadcasting service. So we are literally using drop-down days, 1 or 2 or 3 days, working with year groups, but instead of the presenter in the room, we're just using the screen and working closely with the school to make it happen. So that's how we've advanced. And I guess the frustration I had pre-COVID of running a services company, you know, despite the pain of that, those COVID months, it pushed us onto where we wanted to be, which was working with students all around the world. And it's why I think the webcam and tech, if used properly, can be education's best friend in the next 10 years. It doesn't have to remove things, but this is where we're forming really strong partnerships with schools, is let us do this in a different kind of way. We're your extended teaching arm, but we're going to use tech differently.
Yeah, it's interesting. The model is really interesting, because a lot of the conversations that we're having at the moment, and we were talking about this just earlier on before you came on, David, and that a lot of the trends, I think we're really privileged, actually, because every week we get to talk to amazing people who are innovating in education around the world, and it puts us in quite a unique position, I think, where we start to see trends coming, and we have done over the last 5 years, of different kind of movements happening in education, and they're normally happening abroad, to be fair, because of the rigidity of the education system here. But one of the stronger trends that we've noticed over the last probably 1.5 years is that this whole idea of a decentralized education system, and the fact that private education companies setting up schools mainly online, where students some of them don't necessarily have to go to a physical school. They can go to their school online. So we talked to Garrett Smiley last week from Sora Schools. They've got a whole school set up online. You've got Synthesis in America who are kind of offering some of that, but then also a provision to almost supplement school as well. And same with Kidato in Africa. This kind of trend towards that decentralization of school, where there's going to be other options. I suppose if you look at the UK, you've got kind of the state school system, and then if you've got a bit of money, you can maybe go to a private school. But actually, that there's this whole other thing going on where, and picking up on what you've saying, like a global trend where students anywhere in the world could essentially attend a school being taught out of anywhere in the world. And just your model there, I think it kind of nicely like fits in with that, really. But what you seem to be doing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is still going through the school. I guess 100%.
Like we've got to remember, and we're partners of schools. Like, schools are brilliantly busy places. The pandemic reminded everybody about the single most important purpose of the school. It's a community. In my opinion, it's the first community beyond a family that a child will belong to, and it's crucially important. And I am a massive advocate for that. And it isn't a case of that we're a second school or a partner of a school, because children are only at school for 15% of their waking hours. It's so much time to learn. So we are seeing the rise of some different options for schools. I think we can't ignore the biggest benefit of a school is that community, that interaction, you know, those conversations with your classroom teacher. However, we can integrate tech, right, to enhance opportunity. So at the time we did Home Hack, we were watching what Joe Wicks was doing from a PE perspective and thinking, look, there's something here. You've got a million children having a PE lesson. We can't just see this as a 30-day fad. There's something in this. And then at the same time, I was looking for ways of inspiring my team in a difficult point. So I got my phone book out and I thought, who are my friends who are, you know, quite passionate, can come on and just tell a story? And one of my friends is a car designer working at Tesla. And we grew up at school together, and he was always drawing cars. And he was always drawing cars, 11, 12, 13, wanted to be a car designer. Amazing story. Got a job at Bentley, went back into education, was working in Europe, got headhunted. And it was just a phenomenal story of like resilience and grit and determination. And I was like, every child in the planet who's interested in car design, engineering, STEM, or just wants to hear a great story should hear that. But he was in LA, right? So you had all these different things going on. I think this needs to be integrated into schooling system somehow. We need to now really embrace this. So it's not, we don't see schools as competition at all. We're their partner. Schools are brilliant places. But now we can use tech to offload some of the issues that we've had and provide more opportunities in our schools in the UK and around the world.
I'm going to jump in and always play devil's advocate. So in the current climate.
Yeah.
And the current system and the current regime, they will say, well, do we need it? Because David got and did well and went to IBM and came up with all these ideas, and he didn't have these skills as a focus. He went through the school system that really hasn't changed for a long, long time. And I get it, but for everybody else, what is the why then? If schools are providing a great opportunity anyway, and we've all been through it and done okay in the scheme of things, in terms of if we were rating out of 10, I'm doing a 5, I'm doing all right. Like, you know, if I was to rate myself, but like going through that, why do we need those skills then? If the everybody's saying that the current system is working, or a lot of people are saying the current system works.
Well, you got to look at facts are facts. You can pick and choose what you like, but 80% of people in the UK are dissatisfied with what they do. How do we have an education system where you've got, you know, 24, 25 million working adults not actually content with the day job that they're doing? And that leads on to lots of different other well-being and health issues. So I'd say the system is in parts of the system that is doing brilliantly. There's amazing things going on at school, but we can't accept the answer that it's doing okay. How can we be a world-class country, right, which is developing world-class businesses and services, but have world-class people who are happy accepting the status quo that we've got? So I'm not a basher. I understand the challenges in our schools. If you think about it, there's no other environment where you've got so much emotion in one building, students, parents, teachers, spinning plates, our chances for innovation are so limited. Head teachers, the hardest job in the world, right? Their opportunity to make strategic decisions is probably, I think, no less than probably 21 days a year. There's probably a sweet spot in the middle of each term, which isn't the start and the end, where they're going, I can make a decision now about something we're going to do different next term or next year. All the rest of the time is firefighting. So what we really need to do, and I would love to see, okay, because time is the only common.
Oh, I think David's breaking up there.
Much more appreciation for time in this sector. Why don't we have chief time officers who are finding time back, looking at our processes, clawing 1, 2, or 3 hours a week from being more creative in the way that we've done? It's possible. I bet, okay, I genuinely bet you could find 3 hours a week for every teacher in the United Kingdom if we embrace the theory of marginal gains, found our time in our school and allow our teachers to do what they want to do. So the system isn't doing what it needs to do. Okay, in my eyes, isn't sufficient. Some people are lucky. You know, some people find grit and resilience and determination, ambition through different routes. But that isn't the case. And with so many people just not happy, is that the economy we want? Imagine if it was flipped. Everybody was doing stuff they loved. It was led to our passion and the energy, the enthusiasm. You know, we would be just absolutely storming it.
I absolutely agree. And I think looking at what you're trying to do as an organization is you're acknowledging that things, it's almost, we say this quite a lot, that the world is changing really fast. Industry's changing, finance is changing, everything is changing so fast. Education takes forever to catch up. So I was having a conversation with a guy who runs a digital agency, and he was saying they haven't changed that digital marketing qualification since we were doing it in 2017. I was like, what? That's new. 2017 is relatively new in comparison to some of the specifications that will exist. And so like 5 years for a turnaround, and the conversation about Facebook then, Facebook doesn't even exist as a concept, just as a business on its own. It's part of a broader conversation around Meta and all. It's madness that it hasn't changed. So one of the things that I think is really interesting is that idea of how do we keep up? Because you're talking about here, it's almost like we are doing the cutting edge stuff as an organization that kind of will bolt in to support what schools are doing, because we're acknowledging that schools are, there's fundamentals that need to continue, but the system isn't working. So we're adding this additional value. Is that, am I on the right lines?
The answer then is you can't keep up. Like it's impossible because things are moving so quickly. It's literally impossible. Schools don't have a research and development arm. They don't have people which are sitting around reading and looking to the future and planning lessons. You don't have that resource. So schools can't keep up. And it's not like, we just need to accept that. It's no one's fault. Things are moving too quickly and we don't have 10 people which are sitting there reading about trends and creating lessons for their students which are going to be relevant. We don't have that luxury. So are there alternatives to it? Okay. You take, for example, in the UK, we've probably got 40,000 people writing the same lesson around how to write a good CV. Haven't we? Every school in the country, someone is delivering that particular lesson. Right. Why? You know, why don't we do it in a world-class way, which is right, and then teaching students all at the same time in a different kind of way, so they're all getting that access to learning. So rather than us all scrambling around trying to do this stuff, which we know is important, nobody's ever said to me, entrepreneurship, career education, skills for future, performance and well-being are not important. Nobody's ever disagreed with that, right? But everybody's approach right now is just to do it themselves. And then we don't have enough resources in our schools, even our most privileged schools. We just will never be able to be at the cutting edge of it because schools are brilliantly busy places. So we can't keep up. It's nobody's fault because we don't have millions and millions of pounds to have a team sitting in the school doing all of this. We don't have that. But what we do is let's do what we're going to do really, really well. Let's make it at a world-class level. Let's work with industry. Let's speak to schools. Let's speak to people about what they need to learn in 6 months, 12 months time. We'll build that. And then we can work with our schools to integrate it, but not just 1, 10, 100. We can work with everybody in good time.
Yeah, so I was involved in a project when I was in education in Scandinavia. I think it was Sweden, where they were struggling for modern foreign language teachers. They were really challenged of how could they get high quality delivery to the masses when actually they didn't have enough people to deliver it. So they were using different technology, and I was involved in the program and supporting it from some of the stuff that we were doing in a different guise. And yeah, it's basically taking that, isn't it? For how can you leverage technology to deliver in a great way that isn't passive, but delivers inspiration with the passion that you've got? How do we bottle that, and how do we deliver it on mass? Technology plays a part, both for the students and everything else. And yeah, I totally get it. I was just playing devil's advocate. I wouldn't say it anyway.
We would get requests from across the whole of the UK pre-COVID, and we couldn't service them. It was cost too much. We couldn't get there. The expenses, you know, it just, which is wrong, right? Like, if you've got different schools in the UK around the world who want to benefit from it, and the chances are you can only, you know, it would cost. This is a cost way too much. This is a way greener, a way more sustainable way of doing it. But the challenge we had, so what we were thinking.
I think we've lost David Dirth. I wonder if his internet has dropped out. But just it's interesting. Just before he jumps back in, hopefully he'll be able to jump back in with us. Oh, here he is. It's interesting as we're hearing that. You're back, David. You're back yeah, in the room.
About tech and for some reason the Wi-Fi. What I was going to say was we never wanted to and never will go down the route of sometimes in the ed tech space. It's like, here's your content. There you go. Schools fill your boots. We've always believed in the magic of energy, the live kind of conversation. And so we still have we make sure that even if schools are going through our modular approach or a different pathway, that if they want to speak to someone from ABL, they can. And we still have a hybrid approach. Like, we still get the team into our schools. So we get that real balance of you're going to learn through the screen with us, but we're real people. You can speak some questions, build those rapports. And that's the balance that we're taking right now.
I think it is interesting because in the UK, obviously, when the pandemic hit, lots of people were saying that getting online resources for subjects was difficult, and the government started Oak National, didn't it, as a project that had created content. And I know that there's movement in that currently about where that goes. And essentially, there's a conversation there around whether there is the human element if we're just using content. And I like what you just said there is about, you're talking about content being part of it, but actually the face-to-face synchronous delivery and as well as the building of the rapport and the relationship is important. I think I want to add back if possible that to that the comment you made about the community and about schools being a community and actually the importance of that, because I think part of the issue that we find is that a lot of people who do well in life have not just done well because they had an idea. They had an idea that was then connected to a network of people. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And that we're all living proof of that, I'm guessing. Like, I had a supportive family that supported me with that. I had a contact that helped me get into when I was going to learn, do teaching. I had a really good relationship with my head of sixth form, and he managed to have a little word in to make sure I could get into the university late because I applied late. All these things, these things started to happen, don't they? And I wonder what about that in terms of like the collaboration and the networking and where that plays into this setup.
It's so important. You're right. I mentioned the first thing I did was give my brother a call, who by fortune could do a logo for me, which made me get carried away. I mean, we talk to students about, you know, this world is so connected. Forget about 6 degrees separation. It's moving to sort of 3.5. Right. There's always something to look after it. Right. It doesn't matter where you've grown up, whatever it might be. If we can get that into children early. Right. And the power of that network and the power of platforms like LinkedIn, like, it's just massively, massively can open up doors and create opportunities. We're so connected that someone knows someone. It's important. Right. So I think when we talk about networking, a lot of students still think it's about, I have to go in a room and share a business card and talk to people. I think it's just being conscious of the world is full of connections. Connections can create opportunities. You're building them right from day one. And you can make a late surge as well, right, in terms of how you do that. But I think a lot of people still view, you know, the most successful entrepreneurs and probably people are the most probably resourceful, I would say. They know how to get something done. If they don't know how to do it, they find a way, they find a hack, they find a YouTube video, they do this. So I think that's a skill which needs to be talked about. And another topic is like awareness. I think that's a really good skill that entrepreneurs and leaders have, just being aware of what's going on. Listening is a skill which is often not talked about. But the world is changing quickly, that you don't necessarily need big capital to get ideas moving. There's, you know, with the rise of crowdfunding, which is, you've got a good idea, if the crowd believe in you, whoever you are, whatever your background, they're going to get behind you. And with social media, you can make noise behind an idea. You've got to back yourself. You've got to get started. But yeah, I'm never going to underestimate the power of the network. It's something that, you know, sometimes people say you've got lucky. And I go, no, I haven't. You know, I've worked hard. I've built that network. I've spoken to people. I've connected. I've helped people out. They've helped me. You've got to work at it. You know, you have to work at it.
Yeah, it's interesting that. And the whole idea around students who learn these skills and bringing it into school. I was lucky enough to do a series with the school I was working for a couple of years ago, and I interviewed some famous people from the area, really prominent people who'd gone on to make it big, and a couple who'd gone to the school. And as like, because I used to be the head of careers for the school, and one of the things I wanted to get at is where did the skills come from, and where did literally everyone said it was after school or on a weekend where they learned those skills. Like one of the guys is a good friend of mine, actually. He's a TV editor, does lots of HBO TV shows, and really top of his game at the minute. And he literally would go out on it, and him and his friends would go to the local skate park and up here in Gateshead, and literally they would film it on a weekend, go home, edit it, and then just share it around their friends. And that's where he learned the skills. And then it wasn't actually school. So the fact that we were bringing that type of thing into school I think it's a really exciting prospect that we, to make time for that, so that students who aren't privileged to be able to have the opportunities to do it in their own time or don't have that. Yeah, because I mean, yeah, a lot of students don't have that the privilege to do that because of their backgrounds or their upbringing.
I say I've had four jobs in my life, right? The first was washing dishes. The second was behind a bar. Then it was IBM. Then it was becoming an entrepreneur. So I really wanted to earn money as quickly as I possibly could. So the first job I did was walk down to the local pub and said, do you have any jobs at the age of 13? I was asked to, and I said, yeah, you can wash dishes in the kitchen. To me, that was my first entry of working in a business. And I remember speaking to the landlord at the age of 14 and just saying, why is your business so much successful to any of the other restaurants and pubs? And he taught me the fear of marginal gains. He literally said, we don't waste food or drink. And I remember going, wow, right, that's how you run a business. You know, that's how you do it properly. It's attention to detail. When I was then, you know, lucky enough to go to university, I worked behind a bar. You know, you speak to 200 people a night. I took it as an opportunity to develop my soft skills every night. I was working there for two or three nights a week. And then at IBM, I was taught different things. So these are the things you can pick stuff up in a way. I think I was probably aware of it maybe more than my peers. But I don't remember the word entrepreneurship ever being used when I was at school. Literally, it was business and it was supply and demand was the curve that you learn in my memory. So having those opportunities, and, you know, kids love it. You know, you ask any child, what idea have you got which could change the world? Let's get carried away with it. Give them the opportunity to do it and don't do it once. It's not enough. Like young enterprise at 16, 17, 18, do it often, do it many times. Children should be working on inventions all the time. It unleashes something inside of them. And from that, there are loads of skills you can pick up and you can develop. Whatever it's public speaking, confidence, you know, whatever it might be, resourcefulness, awareness, sketching, all these things I think can be channeled through a great enterprise education strategy in any school.
I suppose a follow-on to that as well, David, is the if students are learning the skills to be successful in business, and it's not coming in the form of a qualification, it's not coming in the form necessarily of a degree at university, how do you see the future of qualifications, and that leads into exams, university even, is that up for grabs?
It's an interesting one, because you look at Twitter, you go, which thread am I going to get involved in, or do I stand back and watch and see? Look, I personally believe there is a role for examinations going forward, right? I don't think it's harmful, that feeling of I'm working towards something. I'm putting myself in a situation where I am going to go test my knowledge. I don't see that being as an issue, because you learn things about yourself and you build resilience at those moments. So I'm not for let's scrap it. What I'm for is a more realistic set of exams that we go for. I would personally like to see, like, if you take GCSE and someone's at 16, I'd much rather have a conversation with a child who's got 5 or 6 GCSEs of the right stuff. I'd like to talk about their portfolio work, projects, inventions that they've been working on, and what they're passionate about, and have a much more balanced conversation with someone at 16 or 18. You know, a child which has got the core knowledge, you can't replace maths, English. We need that stuff, right? Businesses need that. That is what the world is built on. But there is a space, like, whether it's 30% of the time, 40% of the time, whatever it might be, creative projects, you know, empowering young people to get carried away with their imaginations, to write things or investigate stuff that they want to do. That leads to a lifelong passion of curiosity, right? Giving that opportunity for creativity. And then what are you passionate about? And you don't have to be passionate about one thing. You could explode in passion. You go, right, this child has got balance. We're going to help them. We're going to nurture them. There's energy. There's a can-do attitude. We can get there. But so many kids at 16 and 18 haven't got a clue, what they're passionate about, right? Because we're not giving them a chance.
Interestingly, because and I know you'll know that we aren't necessarily either advocates of scrapping exams altogether. We are advocates that much of what we're examining is just in case knowledge rather than just in time. Yeah. And we think that there's some work to do there. We also think that if it's the only measure, it's an unfair measure. But what I do think what you're saying, and what we agree on, and it's not that we disagree on that, because I don't think we do. I think we're on the same page, actually. We're saying foundational stuff, yes, really important. And then what we do with that is allow young people to kind of go into a, help them think, work around helping them think, and then developing an idea and being creative and being curious. Because I love that idea that, I love the idea that we have every young person, and it's not just every young person, it's every person has got within them something that they'd love to explore. Like, I've got a brother who is just obsessed with the Titanic. Like, there's not many people in the world that you would say probably that are as obsessed as he is with it. He knows the amount of windows that it had and the trajectory that it went on and all that kind of stuff because he's passionate about it. Amazing. But that's not just an interest. If he could do something to help educate and make that interesting and tell that story beyond just the story of the film, like that could be his thing that he gets excited about. I get excited about all sorts of things. I love being able to explain a concept in a short amount of words in a piece of writing. I love that. I love it when I can kind of be creative with the way that things are written. So what I'm saying is, I am rambling a little bit, but what I am saying is that everybody's got. I'm agreeing with this idea that everybody's got an idea. I think the principle behind what you're talking about is helping to create a program, or a set of a platform or whatever that looks like, to help people explore their ideas and then put them into practice. I wonder that ties into that. Obviously, you mentioned about the work that you're doing with Sir Clive Woodward. I wonder if you could just give our listeners a little bit of an insight into what that looks like, because obviously we are big fans. Well, I'm certainly a big fan of the work that he did around the Teacup, Thinking Correctly Under Pressure stuff. Obviously, we're all big fans of Jake Humphrey and Damien Hughes podcast, the High Performance Pod, which is obviously tied into what you're talking about there. So I wonder if we could just specialize in that bit for a moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it's not just about just ideas. It's just exploring passions and getting curious. There's a few things there. Like, I worry about the timetable. Like, how can we really nurture creativity when the bell just keeps on going? It just stops flow states all the time. And you look at organizations like Google went to 20% time, literally giving 20% time back to staff to work on projects, any project that they wanted to do, and led to the rise of so many of the new Google products, and empowerment went up. So I think there's an argument there of let's keep a balanced set of knowledge and exams, just find time a little bit more to make our schools just hubs of creativity, whatever the passion might be. And it doesn't, if you're interested in Titanic, let's go explore it. You don't know where it's going to go, and you can be passionate about more than one thing. So I think we're kind of in agreement there. And but the second thing is, which is away from entrepreneurship. You know, we had a head teacher we were working. He was advising a ski academy in France, and they very focused on trying to nurture and develop the top skiers to take on at the Winter Olympics. And the direct sport was Sir Clive Woodward. Who after Team GB, this was one of the next projects he got involved in, very much focused on the performance. So no skiing background, but just looking at it, how do we help improve performance, looking beyond the sport itself? So brain fitness, digital dexterity, nutrition, sleep, eyesight, all these different things which make a big difference when you're performing under pressure. And he had a frustration that this could be really relevant for any child of any ambition. And we had the opportunity to talk at the back end of last year, and we were like, hell yeah, we completely agree with you. That's stuff that I've been passionate about and been exploring from a distance, like listening to, you know, Jake and Damien, and obviously growing up with the theory of marginal gains and hearing what was happening in the world of sports. So we looked at it. And we said, look, we can do something about what you're doing with these experts, but we need to make it relevant for a 12-year-old in any part of the world who's not interested in sport, but just wants to perform better. They might want to be a teacher, an academic, a lawyer, whatever it might be. So we created this really cool program, which we piloted and got an average rating from our teenagers of 4.8 out of 5. And it was just phenomenal. But when we launched it as a performance program, everybody came back and told us, actually, you've created something which is going to really help with well-being. Because fundamentally, these things are about helping to deal with under pressure. And the stuff that we were talking about was going to really support a lot of schools' well-being strategy. So we created it, and I think we've opened a can of worms, because the first thing we did was, in the speed of time, was let's go build it for some, you know, key stage 4 and 5. As soon as we did that, it was like, what does this look like for 4, 5, 6-year-olds? So we're just building out the philosophy and the approach in that space, but we're dead excited about it. It's yeah, we're really, really chuffed with it.
That's class. It sounds really good. And I guess what's next for 8 Billion Ideas in terms of where are you going with, what's your intent? Are you wanting this to get into every school, every college out there? You want it to, Is there a bit of a lobby inside to what you're doing in terms of getting this, as getting secured time within school timetables? Like, where does this go?
Well, deliberately, our second word of our mission statement is every, because we never wanted to get pigeonholed into any part of the sector. So we're very proud that we work across age group, cross curriculums, cross demographic, cross sector. So when you look at our partners, you know, we've got such an array of brilliance there across it from such a variety of schools and colleges, which is great. So very much we want to continue with this mission. It doesn't mean that you can do it overnight, right? There's so many things against us, but we are very fully committed about it. So any school approaches us, we will always find a way of working with them. For now, the real focus of us is in those four areas, is continuing to develop the experiences and lessons, because we have about 200 experiences which pan those four different areas, but we actually need to move towards 2000. So we've kind of got that utopia vision of what does it look like every week if a child is going to go through this type of learning. So that's very much the focus for us, is working with experts, psychologists, the world of industry, taking our ideas to the table, listening to students and schools and mapping that out. So we are very much busy with our schools, but what we're doing is just planning for 12, 18 months, 2 years down the line of making sure we've got that brilliant view of what a child could or, you know, could go through when they go through school. So that's number one. Number two was some of the challenges we faced when we launched 8 Billion Ideas was giving schools more flexibility. So when they're doing a timetabled lesson, you know, one of the challenges you have is noise, and particularly if you're broadcasting in. So if Ben's being really loud in the corner, you know, what do you do in that scenario? So we had to pivot and make a few changes to allow them to kind of press stop and rewind and work with them. So we're just ironing out a few things there. And then lastly, it's just continuing to build our partnerships. So we've got a great set of schools in the UK, the Middle East, in Asia. We've got our first school in Africa, which we're working with week after next. So we will keep growing. And I think we've been lucky. A lot of it's been word of mouth. We've done next to no marketing so far, a little bit of awareness. And I guess it's, you in a way, you become accredited by the schools, like by working with you and by endorsing you and shouting about it, you become self accredited by the sector in itself. So hopefully long may that continue.
And are there any plans? I don't know, this might happen already, sorry if it is, for individual students to access the material without having to go through their school?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things there. So with our platform, students which are taking part in the learning, if the school are engaged with it, can access us anytime. So if you've got a 12 or 13 year old for that school's working on a side hustle and they're going through learning with us and they really want to talk about their business, they can get in contact after school at the weekend. In terms of like that pure kind of B2C element, so you know, us working with students out there, currently the access is obviously via the parent. If they want their child to do that. But we're constantly exploring. We've got our scholarship program. If there's any child out there who just hears about us, wants to work with us, you know, financially not in a position to do it, we kind of find a way. But it's part of our mission. We keep, as a team, meeting every 4 or 5 weeks, looking at the every word. What else is our responsibility to get out there? We've got great partnerships with African Promise, Kilimanjaro, Young Girls in Need, doing projects just to help us. But we've got to keep growing, we've got to keep doing, we've got to keep partnering to allow us to do even more, I guess is the key.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, I suppose, for anybody who's been listening to this this podcast this evening, they'll now understand why our judges chose David as our Edufuturist of the Year this year. Obviously, there's loads going on. And it's not just filling loads of stuff. You're actually trying to make a difference. And I love that for those who are viewing, you can see in the background that mission statement about giving every student on the planet the skills and belief to change the world. And I think that's...
Well, I can show you here. This is my kind of, I'd say, my vision ball, right? All the reason why we get out of bed every single day is to make good moments, make students smile as well and enjoy what they do.
Yeah, and I think testament to that, and we're really glad to hear that you were chosen as a winner by our judges, and I think long may that continue. I think there's very much a synergy in what you're saying and what we've been we're talking about, and I think there's a synergy with the other podcast guests we've had on recently who are trying to add something to say the education is in need of a shift. Okay isn't okay. I love that phrase, by the way. Okay isn't okay. We can't accept okay. And we've got an opportunity to do something different. So, David, thanks for joining us this evening. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks for the work that you're doing. And well done on winning the award again.
Thank you very much. It meant the world to me. I've always said we don't need a revolution, but we do need an evolution. That's what we need right now in the sector. So keep up the good work, Ben, Dan, Steve. Thank you ever so much for having me. And look forward to speaking soon.
Thanks, David.
Cheers, David.